The Future Proof Podcast from News Talk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. My name is Jonathan McRae. Thanks for subscribing and downloading. Let your friends know about the podcast if you enjoy it. I think you'll like this one. Warning though, if you're eating, maybe just pause and come back to it later. Because this week we're going to be talking about the creatures that live in and on your face, the Demodex. If you'd like to email us, you can do so, science@newstalk.com. You can also find us on Twitter, we're at @newstalkscience. Before we get down and dirty, so to speak, let's go and have a look at what's been going on in the science world over the past week. Joining us via Skype are Dr. Susan Kelleher and Dr. Shane Bergen, both from UCD this week. You're both very welcome, guys. Our first story.
From Russia with love, I fly to you.
Is about the news that Russia has announced a vaccine for COVID-19, Susan, met with a lot of skepticism. What's going on here?
So Russia have announced that they have approved a vaccine for COVID-19. And that is the first step in a vaccine being rolled out towards in the wider community. The reason this is somewhat controversial is because Russia haven't shown that they've done what we would call the phase three clinical trials, which would be the trials that you would need to do before the general use of a vaccine would be approved. Now, they've shown that they've done phase one clinical trials and phase two clinical trials, and they are the trials. Phase one shows that the dosage of the vaccine is effective and not harmful. The second, which is phase two, shows that you can get an immune response. So you produce antibodies or you produce T cells against the disease. Now, phase three is generally done on tens of thousands of people. And it shows that when you give half the population, let's say, or half those people a placebo and half of them are given the vaccine, that those who are given the vaccine, at least 50% of those gain immunity against the disease. And once that happens, we know that there's a safe and approved vaccine. And moreover, those phase three clinical trials also show that there are no side effects that may be quite rare or quite substantial, however, just not in the smaller cohorts of people with the phase one and phase two clinical trials. So that's really where the questions around this and how safe it really is, as they've claimed it to be rather safe, that's where the questions arise.
Obviously, those phases, as you described them, are there because of things that have happened in the past where vaccines hadn't probably been tested. And we know there's a litany of horror stories from the development of medicines that haven't properly been tested, blind tested in a larger population to ensure safety. There is quite rightly a lot of outcry, I'd imagine, from the international community. But of course, politically, you would imagine the country that gets the vaccine may also end up being the richest country in the world overnight. And so politically, people probably don't want Russia to get a vaccine, even though they may.
Well, I don't think it's a case of one country getting a vaccine and other countries not. I think it's really fair to say that there are about 6 to 8 vaccines, including this one. Well, this has been approved, but there are about 6 to 8 that are in clinical phase three clinical trials from companies in the UK, the US, and in China. And to be fair, they're actually further ahead than the Russian Institute in terms of the efficacy and the effectiveness of this type of vaccine. So it's kind of nearly like a case that if you're baking a cake and your cake was half done, that you took it out of the oven and you said, hey, look, I've got a cake. You don't have a cake, you've got half a cake. And there's other people who've got maybe a cake that's further on down the line to being ready. So, and of course-
Great cake analogy, Susan.
Well, obviously cakes aren't very harmful, thankfully.
No, I get your point. What I'm saying though is, if a country manages to come up with an efficacious vaccine, the patents and the income from that is absolutely huge. So everybody's rushing. And the fact that the Russians have released or approved this vaccine, even though, as you say, it hasn't been proven to be safe, is probably a gamble on that, because there's so much pressure to develop this quickly because of the global pandemic we're in. And this sort of nonsense is only going to put more pressure on the United Kingdom, America, France, Germany, wherever else, China, where these vaccines are being developed in line with proper protocol.
I think that's a very fair point. I would say that even if this produces a very good response in terms of immunity, it isn't going to be produced, even if at the very best manufacturing methods, it's not going to be enough to create enough vaccine for everybody. So there will be multiple ways of doing this, and there will be lots of different types of vaccines that different countries will get. And right. Even then, the rollout will be quite slow. You know, I think Pfizer's vaccine that they're producing in Germany, they'll get 1.3 billion doses by the end of 2021, which is still a small portion of people who need vaccines around the world. And I think the figures for this Russian vaccine are 1.5 million, which is, again, a tiny portion of actually the people in Russia alone, yeah. So let alone sort of the Philippines and other countries that are backing Russia on this and happy to sort of put in orders for this. It will be really a global effort at the end of the day. And I, for one, would be happier taking something that has been proven to be tested rigorously. We do know that about 20% of vaccine, 20% of vaccines that are in phase three clinical trials fail, and they fail substantially for serious reasons of death or increased problematic, situations when people are actually taking the vaccines.
No, it's properly terrifying. And the fact that they are rolling it out to the vulnerable and medical professionals first, I mean, it could be a recipe for disaster. Our second story, Shane, has to do with something a little bit more benign. The fastest star ever recorded.
Yeah, let physics just take you away from the nightmare that is COVID-19 for a little while. We are still the science of hope and possibility, you know. So sometimes pointless, but sometimes not so pointless. And this is a pointless story, but very, very interesting. And it is an observation of the fastest star in the Milky Way. When I read it first, I was like, stars aren't fast. What does it mean? And so what's happening here is that this star is orbiting a black hole in Sagittarius A, that part of the sky for people that know that sort of thing. And it's moving at 8% the speed of light. So incredibly quickly, 24,000 kilometers per second. And it's quite literally circling the drain. And it is a type of star called a squeezer. Which means that it's a squeezer. Yeah, it's a great name, isn't
it? How have I not heard that?
I know, I hadn't heard of it either. Maybe they made it up. No, I doubt they did. It was published in the Astrophysical Journal and German scientists, so quite serious, I'm sure. And they describe it taking this daredevil orbit as it loops around the black hole that will eventually consume it in something called a tidal disruption event. Listeners may remember that we discussed such events back in January when images were taken. What happens when a smallish black hole like this swallows a star? Basically what happens is it spaghettifies the star. So it stretches it out in one dimension, and it starts to consume the matter of the star. It glows incredibly hot, and the black hole will emit X-rays that we can observe. And that's what's about to happen to this star.
You're absolutely right. When we think of stars, we don't think of them as moving objects. But of course, everything is moving in the sky, and planets are moving around. So stars are moving around their galaxies, and galaxies themselves are moving around the universe. Is it tricky to sort of measure speed when everything is moving like that?
Absolutely it is. And what you need to do is, astronomers are very good at looking at relatively fixed points in the night sky, such as the North Star, and looking at relative movement to it. It was really this sort of physics was what put me off becoming an astronomer. I could never get my head around this three-dimensional geometry that they have to do in order to be able to work out how things are moving in the night sky. That and the various complicated names that they have for labeling all of these angles and distances. But this is pretty cool, like, to be able to see a star that is being squeezed and glowing as a result of that squeeze, and seeing it in its death throes as it is gobbled up by a black hole.
Susan, our third story is a rather unpleasant one, and to do with pigs.
Yeah, so this is a paper that was published some time ago in the Nature, Journal of Nature. And it's just basically says that scientists in Yale have restored some function to the brains of pigs that had been dead for several hours. So to put that in context, they took the brains, they hooked them up to apparatus called Brain X that simulates the circulatory system of a pig. So it has pumps that pump just like the heart, and it's got filters that filter just like the kidney, and it moves oxygen around. So into this, they pumped a special cocktail of different chemical compounds that mimicked the activity, or sorry, the active components of blood. So when they did this and they circulated all this solution through the brain, they saw that the brain started to show signs of function restoring. So it started to metabolize sugars, it started to take oxygen back up again, the cells in the brain, which is really like completely changes the idea of what it means to be dead, or for a cell or a brain to be dead. Now, it's not living. I mean, that's really important to say here, that this isn't a living brain.
It's not a zombie pig.
No, we're well, I have to say, just to clarify, we are very far away from zombie pigs, unfortunately, if that was what you were hoping to hear today. But it is a cellularly active brain. And they did really, like, from an ethical point of view, it's obviously quite a gray area, but they purposely inhibited any neuronal activity. So they made sure that there was absolutely no chance that this was going to start firing neurons and starting to have a consciousness and starting to realize what was going on. So that was completely quashed. But they did take out neurons from the brain, individual ones, and started to see that they were firing when they had been activated in a similar way. So, I mean, the big thing
is... Wait. That's a big point. So what you're saying is, in this experiment where they essentially brought activity back to a dead pig's brain, you're saying that they didn't go near the higher functioning consciousness parts of the brain, but had they wanted to, this cocktail would have caused firing in the thinking part of the brain, the seeing part in the brain.
I think that's maybe a bit too big a stretch. I think they've seen some. I mean, we know we can maybe activate neurons just from an electrical point of view. I mean, right. That's what a neuron is. But they certainly didn't go there. They've made a very clear statement that that's not where they would go with this yet. And if they ever went there, but it is interesting that if you think of it as two pieces and putting them together, what could be possible? I don't think we'll know that. But what we will be able to know is using this brain, the amazing thing about this is if you are trying to study how the brain works as a whole organ, and you're trying to understand disease in the brain, you have to do that in live models. You have to do that in animals, you have to do it in people. Whereas if you have a brain that functions as a unit, albeit without these neuronal activity. So this is where they see this going in terms of really understanding how the brain can work and how the brain as a unit can function in terms of disease progression. And also, I mean, there is a philosophical question, of course, is what is dead now? These were brain dead cells, and they were brought back to life. To life.
It depends on where you live, right? I mean, dead is different in different countries. And you are clinically dead in America, but in China or India, how they define dead, whether it's a stopped heart, no brain function, or so on, it varies slightly from place to place, which I think is really interesting. So I don't think even the idea of death has fully been figured out just yet. Or what we call it for medical reasons. Shane, our final story is a really interesting one, because I had always assumed that our solar system was like everything else that we see out there, round. But new data suggests that it is not round, that our solar system, with the sun at the center, is a different shape.
Yeah, and before I talk about that, a chiff-chaff just flew into our window like a few minutes ago. I thought it was well dead. It's now sitting up and it looks like it's about to take off. So not dead. but you asked me about this work from Nature Astronomy from Harvard and Maryland about the size of our, or the shape rather, of our solar system. And yes, we thought that basically it had an outer boundary. So like, how do you draw an edge or a boundary on something like a solar system? It's not like there's, you know, the next county out. Basically beyond the solar system is just nothing. It's interstellar medium until you get to another solar system. So it's kind of like a sea. out there, and we're an island within it. And we thought that our edge, which is defined by something called the heliosphere, the region in which the sun dominates, that it would have a spherical shape, but it doesn't. In fact, they're describing it in this paper published recently as croissant-shaped.
Croissant-shaped.
Basically it is not spherical. And the way they've been able to do that is by looking at ions or particles that are bouncing from the edge of the heliosphere back toward the sun, and we're able to kind of have a look at those. The most sensible way to do this would be to shoot things through the heliosphere and kind of measure how far you had to go before you went through the barrier. But we've only two man-made objects that have ever done that, Voyagers 1 and 2. So with only two data points, we can't say much, as my PhD supervisor used to remind me continuously. So we have to look at this sort of backscattered particle, and they follow something called pickup ions. So these are particles that are moving, and they're a lot hotter than the regular stuff coming from the sun. And so there's this interplay between these hot riders and the normal stuff. And so you get this mix between them, and that mix is what's creating the confused boundary or the irregular shape of our solar system. This is very early days in the research. It's, again, sort of a pointless story, but yet very, very interesting. And so there's an awful lot of measurement to be done and computer modeling to be done with those measurements in order for us to really determine the proper shape of our solar system.
Well, you heard it here first, folks. Our solar system is croissant-shaped. Thank you very much for that piece of information, Shane. Dr. Shane Bergen and Dr. Susan Kelleher from UCD, thanks very much. Now, if you look at a picture of the Earth from space, it really is beautiful. You don't see the many little creatures scurrying around on its surface, pooping and having sex with each other and generally making a mess of the place. It's important for you to remember that the next time you look at yourself in the mirror. I will explain all in a bit, but just a warning, if you're feeling a little down or a little unpleasant at the moment, the next conversation may not be for you. With that said, I'm welcoming our guest, Professor of Microbiology at NUI University. His name is Kevin Kavanagh. I welcome to the program, Kevin. How are you?
Thank you very much, Jonathan. It's lovely to speak to you.
Before we go into this, I suppose what I'd like to start off with is kind of talking about what the general public knows about the things that live on their bodies. How well informed do you think the general public is?
I think people are aware that we carry with us a range of bacteria and fungi and other microbes. They generally view them in a negative light, that they cause disease, they cause illness, but we also have a range of other microbes which are very beneficial to us. So you can think of us as a bus, the human body as a bus, and there's lots of passengers on board. Lots of these do us favours, lots of them cause problems, but they're there nonetheless.
So I think that's where I stood, and I generally viewed bacteria as being neither good nor bad, but good in some cases and bad in others. But there are other organisms that live on us that I suppose people might not be aware of. Can you tell us about the Demodex and what it looks like?
Certainly. We have on our faces creatures which are called Demodex mites. And these live in the skin of our face. They live in the sebaceous gland on the skin of the face. They can eat the oil that's produced on our skin, and they eat dead cells. They can move around quite freely. And there are two species found in humans. The larger of the two species is about 0.3 of a millimeter long, so just visible to the naked eye. And then there's a second species, which is about 0.1 of a millimeter long and lives deep in the skin of the face. So when we look in the mirror, we're actually looking, though we don't realize it, at the home for these mites. They live in our skin, they'll travel around on the surface of the skin, and they also mate on the surface of the skin and lay their eggs while we're asleep.
Okay, I have lots of questions, but you didn't answer my first one, which was, what do they look like?
Okay, well, the larger of the two, as I said, is about 0.3 of a millimeter long. It has a mouth, it has four pairs of legs, and it has an abdomen, which is sort of oval-shaped.
It kind of looks like a spider in a way, does it?
Yeah, they're actually, you're correct. They are actually related to spiders. They're distant relations of spiders, yeah.
And is it only the less hygienic of us that has these Demodex mites on and inside their face?
No, everybody has them. There's nothing to do with hygiene. We pick these up around the age of 12 or 14 from close contact with family or friends. So there's direct contact between one face and the other. And irrespective of somebody's cleaning regime or their diet, we still have them. They live quite happily.
What about these products that say they kill 99% of bacteria? That's just not relevant here, right? Because these are not bacteria or viruses. Are they technically animals?
They're technically animals, yeah. They're free to move around. They have a mouth, a body. They have four pairs of legs. And, you know, they're free living mites.
They're arthropods, yeah? So that's the same as insects and crabs.
Yes, in the same family, yeah, as the insects, crabs, and spiders.
So why do they lay their eggs on our face when we're sleeping?
Well, I suppose it's convenient. This is where they live. So two mites will come together and while we're resting, and then eventually eggs will be laid in the skin of the face. They will hatch after about 8 or 10 days, and then they develop into a nymph or a young mite. And then this develops and lives for about 3 weeks, and then it dies at the end of that time. So, and then the whole process is repeated again. They are unique in the animal kingdom. If we think of all the animals that we know of in the world, from the microscopic to the very large, they are unique in one feature, and that is that they can't get rid of waste during their life. So for their entire life, they cannot get rid of the metabolic waste. So they don't.
So, I mean, as a positive, we could say at least they don't defecate on us.
Yes, while they're alive. However, the problem arises when they die, because when they die, all this material that they've accumulated over their life of about 3 weeks is released into the skin. And this is what causes the problem. Because if it was released on a regular basis over their life, it would be a very low level of impact on the skin. However, all of this being released at a single time can cause problems to the immune system of the face and lead to problems.
Like what?
So there can be inflammation on the face. There can be the formation of spots and literally papules on the face, which contain pus, where the body is trying to fight off the effects of the mite. Well, and this leads to diseases like acne, similar to acne.
But not acne. Because not acne is a buildup of sebum as well, right? That oily substance that we usually find around the follicle of a hair.
Exactly. You're correct. So it leads to the formation of a condition known as rosacea, which has some similarities to acne. And it's also similar in that sebum is implicated because the mites are eating the sebum, their population is increasing, and then they are causing the problems.
If by some fluke you're still listening to this, I imagine, like me, you are furiously itching. And that is a normal response to this horrific piece of news. I am so sorry to be delivering it, but we thought it was a fascinating subject. And indeed it is. Why the face? Why is a face such a good place for these mini parasites to live and reproduce on?
The main reason is the production of sebum. So this oily substance on the face that we find. So they're found on the face. They're also found, or they can also live on the skin above the sternum in the middle of the chest, again, where you find sebum, and also at the back of the neck, where there's also levels of sebum produced. So it seems to be that they will live in an area where they have a food source.
Right, which I suppose makes sense. How many are we talking about? Like, is it, I mean, if they're visible, it can't be millions.
No, you're correct. They're not that many. Under normal conditions, if you look at the skin, there's one or two Demodex mite per square centimetre. So the top of your finger would be about a square centimetre. If you put that on your face, you're probably covering one or two Demodex mites. In disease states, this density increases to between 10 and 20 per square centimetre.
Oh, disgusting, Kevin. My God.
And this is the problem, because instead of having a low level of fecal material released on a regular basis, you now have 10 to 20 times that amount being released into the skin, causing irritation.
If you're still with us somehow, you're listening to News Talk, and this is the science program Future Proof. I'm Jonathan McRae. We're speaking with Dr. Kevin Kavanagh from Maynooth University about something that's new to me. It may not be to you, but a species of mite that lives healthily and happily on all of our faces all of the time, it seems, as soon as we hit around puberty. What about the fact that they live in our skin? Is that a problem? The other species that live inside the skin, are they unique in that regard, or are there lots of other creatures living in our skin?
They live in our skin, as you say, quite happily. There are a range of bacteria also live in our skin and don't cause problems. The problem arises with the Demodex mites when their number or their density increases, and this then causes the pilosebaceous unit, which you can think of it like a little jug. If you can imagine, one of these guys is lying in this jug in the face, but if there's 10 or 20, they distend it, they expand the jug. This causes problems for the skin. And also, as they're releasing all their fecal material at the end of their life, this is causing irritation to the immune system, leading to inflammation and leading to tissue damage. So normally they're harmless, but if their numbers increase, they cause a problem.
Is it a parasitic relationship? Do we benefit in any way from these Demodex?
This has been debated. It may be, well, they certainly play a role in eating dead cells on the skin of the face. They may keep areas clean, if you like. But and normally, for most people, their numbers aren't a problem. It's only when their numbers increase rapidly that you see a disease state. So, are they parasitic or endosymbiotic? They may be doing us a little favor, but we're certainly doing them a bigger favor.
Just to go back a bit, you said that they're a third of a millimeter and barely visible to the human eye. Mm-hmm. I mean, being a microbiologist, if we were having this conversation face to face, would you be able to see these things moving on my face?
It's possible to extract them from the face fairly easily. And for example, put them on a microscope slide and you can see them, or even with a large magnifying glass, you'll see them. If you want to see what they look like, you can Google Demodex mites, and when they're taken from the face, their legs are still moving. So they're still alive. Their legs are moving. Their mouth parts are opening and closing, and they eventually slow down and die after about an hour out of the face.
For those who are saying, you know, after the year that we've had, not now, face mites, it should be pointed out that we've known about face mites and we've had them for a very long time. It's just news to me, and presumably by some logic, also to some of our listeners, that we've known that these have been around for some time.
Yeah, for sure. And indeed, as I said, there's two groups of Demodex mites on our face. There's the larger one, which is called Demodex folliculorum, and the smaller one called Demodex brevis. Now, we have good evidence that the larger of the two mites, Demodex folliculorum, we picked up from dogs when humans domesticated dogs about 15,000 years ago. There was and is a Demodex mite on dogs called Demodex canis, and this apparently got onto humans and has changed slightly to live on humans, but it's very closely related to the Demodex that we find in dogs. So we can sort of tie that into the domestication of dogs. The other mite, Demodex brevis, which is much smaller, we share with other primates. Oh. So we seem to have had this for in humans for at least 200,000 or maybe 250,000 years. And this, many people consider the true Demodex mites of humans, whereas the Demodex, the larger one, is the one we picked up from dogs.
Are these unique in regard to humans because they are animals that they're not bacteria or viruses, they're animals that live on us and sort of depend on us in a way that perhaps other sorts of parasites such as lice and those burrowing creatures, that that's part of a life cycle, or they don't need humans to live. Are Demodex sort of just part of the human ecosystem?
Yes, you are correct. The other parasites that you mention, we pick up, they cause disease.
Lyme disease and so on.
Exactly, and they're gone. Whereas these guys, the Demodex, are part of our natural body, flora and fauna. Most of the time, we're not even aware they're there. In certain cases, they cause disease, but otherwise they're literally below the radar. So they're, if you like, they're very silent passengers.
Are there other equivalents, like scabies comes to mind, and mange in dogs?
That's right, yeah. So mange, there's different types of mange in dogs, but there's one type of mange which is caused by Demodex mites again.
Right.
This involves the Demodex mite burrowing into the skin, damaging the skin, and there's hair loss. So again, the normal numbers can be kept low in a dog, but if the dog is ill or malnourished, these guys would get a chance to cause problems.
If I wanted to remove these creatures from my face, would I be able to do that easily enough? Or are there treatments to get rid of those? Is that just stupid?
There are some treatments which purport to help get rid of the mites. But the reality is that I'd say for every 20 you remove, there's another 20 elsewhere. So and they quickly recolonize areas. They're just something that we have lived with for thousands of years, and something that we just continue to live with. The only problem they produce is when they cause skin irritation, when their numbers increase dramatically.
You know, there's a phrase, what you didn't know won't hurt you. And I suppose that very much was the case for many people before this interview. But now, if like me, they are extremely uncomfortable with this knowledge, there's no going back, really, is there? You can't unlearn this stuff, Kevin. Is this something that you are you grossed out by any of this, or being a microbiologist, you're probably privy to much worse. But on a visceral human level, you can be professional and say, well, this is just the natural world. But deep down in your innermost heart, doesn't this gross you out?
Not really, no. So if you think about it, humans are part of the natural ecosystem on the planet. As well as these Demodex mites, you know, we contain billions of bacteria, millions.
They haven't got legs,
you Kevin. Know, all over. Yeah. So we're walking petri dishes.
Right. Well, thank you, I think is the correct words. Professor Kevin Kavanagh, Professor of Biology and Biological and Biomedical Science at NUI University in Maynooth. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
All right. Love to know what you made of that story. Did you enjoy it like I did, or were you completely grossed out? I was going to say, did you have to turn off? But if you did turn off, you're not hearing this. So let us know anyway, science@newstalk.com. You can also tweet us at newstalkscience. And it's time to look back at some of your texts and tweets from last week. Producer Aidan McKelvey joins me. How's your week been, Aidan?
It's been good. I've been scratching my face since I talked to Kevin earlier in the week for the briefing call.
It's so gross, isn't it?
It's gross.
It's really gross. Yeah, properly gross. And actually, I've just scratched my nose again. Like it's not one for COVID-19, that particular story. Anybody listening to it while out in public is probably touching their face and doing all the things you shouldn't be doing. So just to get some of your comments from last week, somebody was giving out to Lara. I asked her, like, you know, what do we know about this? And she said, we just don't have that data. And someone texted in saying, posh talk, why don't you just say no real info? I have to say, I think we're quite good at that. Like every once in a while, we do use a technical term, but I think we're quite man of the people in the way we talk about science. I don't know. I'm not a specialist, so I don't know the fancy terms for stuff. I think we're quite accessible, aren't we, Aidan?
We're both ignorant enough, myself and yourself, to keep it accessible.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
We have to understand
it. Must be every man, because we are every man. I hear a song breaking out there, but I'm not going to do it. Vincent has gotten in touch. He said we were interviewing Emily Levesque, who is an astronomer. She was talking to us about this experience where she was in the 747 in the stratosphere, and they opened up the window to take images with a telescope. And Vincent says, how did you not follow up with that question? That sounds like an amazing experience. I did, but producer Aidan, in his wisdom, cut it out of the edit. So that was an edited piece. And Aidan,
but listen to the podcast.
Yeah, you can listen to the podcast. In the podcast, you actually get to hear the full, unedited, probably not as good version. Thanks for that, Aidan.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Jonathan just says so many interesting things that we couldn't possibly keep them all in the show.
Oh,
you know?
Man. Like, I have to keep Aidan sweet, because if I let him put anything that we actually, if we pre-record, I just go off on one. Pre-recording is not good for me. And if we do one of those, I just need Aidan to take care of it, because it's never pretty. We also were talking about the brain-computer interfaces and how they might be able to restore function. And someone says getting closer to the RoboCop model all the time. There are lots of ways that you can use lots of things in that sort of interchange, that crossroads of technology and medicine. There's always a doomsday scenario and a utopian scenario, right? You know, like the potential of this brain implant would be that, you know, it could restore function to people who are paralyzed. And then, the potential for that brain computer interface is that we could put it in people and use their bodies like slaves. Like, you know, there's always a counter argument. We're hoping that the medicine people, the doctors and the scientists, will use this technology for good. But yes, much like a pen, you could either use it to sign the Declaration of Independence or stab someone in the back with it. And then on Twitter, we had Pork, who was giving out to us for using our measurements in Imperial. I don't think it was me, in fairness. Although I kind of, when it's not important and it's small, I think feet and inches is a bit easier in just kind of general chat. Obviously, like if you're making a scientific measurement or you're recording something, the metric system is great. It's weird. Yeah. How do you feel about it, Aidan? Like, I'm not going to correct someone from America if they're using the imperial system, I know, and say, well, what is that in meters? Because that's just not a very flowing conversation. But for me, like, I prefer kilometers to miles, but I prefer inches to centimeters. So what does it say about me?
Yeah, there's a weird crossover in Ireland. And I think actually he said here as well, yeah, like if the expert says it, I think you just have to leave it, because that's kind of the that's their responsibility and that's their measurement that they're using. But and I remember you and I actually chatted about, he's mentioned here one of the promos that we might have used Imperial System as well. But I think it was in relation to the height of somebody. You were given an example of the height of somebody. And not to say that, you know, I was riding them with Pork. I think I was saying we should go metric, but you made a point, which is fair enough, that most people in Ireland probably do put their height in like feet, 6 feet,
I've
5 feet.
I have no idea
something.
How many centimeter I am tall. I know I'm 6'1".
Yeah, but it does annoy me though. It's like, why can't we all just agree to stick to one? Because it's just like the Imperial System is ridiculous. It's all over the place. Like,
well, if it comes down to politics, Aidan, you know, like, if it's very expensive to switch over to anything, as we saw with the euro, and as we will see with Brexit, all, you know, any major widespread change, and certainly changing how you measure everything and how you describe everything, is a fairly major change. My biggest bugbear in this area is oven temperature. Like, you know, gas Mark V equates to what? And then if they, even if they give you the Celsius, they don't give you whether or not it's a fan oven or not. And no, everyone's got a fan oven now. Fans, ovens have been around everywhere. It's the default. Give us the fan oven. Forget the other one. If you live in the countryside and you have an AGA, I'm sorry, you are now in the minority, and you will have to adjust to the new world order of McRae, in which we measure things by temperature of a flipping fan oven. Starts today.
McRae is so science, he wants his temperatures in Kelvin.
Yeah, exactly.
none of this metric stuff. My bugbear is actually the 24-hour clock, because I wonder how many seconds of my life I've wasted saying, oh, that's at 8 o'clock, and then someone goes, AM or PM? It's like, if it was just 24 hours, I'd never have to answer that question. If you topped them all up, that's a lot of time in your life.
I also get very confused still as a 44-year-old man between 18. Like, I look at 18 and I usually go, that's 8 o'clock at night. And they go, no, it's 6 o'clock at night.
Yes,
I pat myself in the back like, come on. Right. I guess that's it for this week's podcast. Thanks to Aidan McKelvey, who you heard there producing. Simon Keane was on sound. Simon Keane was researching, and on sound was Stephen McClune. I was Jonathan McRae. There'll be more in the podcast feed during the week, and a fresh Future Proof next Saturday, as always. In the meantime, stay curious.